death for a convicted killer or life in prison. A local family wants justice for their murdered daughter, but their wishes are sparking debate. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Ross. Hope you had a great weekend. Just ahead, we'll take your calls on a controversial death penalty case. Where do you stand on the death penalty? Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, it's a preview of tonight's big PBS television event, America After Charleston. Plus, sports with Cole as the Jaguars win one at home. Plus, we'll meet new Jacksonville Suns owner Ken Babby as he tells us about his plans. All of that ahead. But we begin the hour with a look at Florida's death penalty. On Friday, the First Coast Tiger Bay Club hosted a debate about it. As WJCT's Lindsay Kilbride reports, Jacksonville's judicial circuit issues more death sentences than any other in Florida.
Christina Musanti debated on behalf of the Justice for Jacksonville Coalition. She says the death penalty has major problems.
The last study that was done in cost in Florida was over 10 years ago, and they found that the death penalty cost $51 million per year over the cost of life without parole.
She says take that money and use it for something else. Debate attendee Mark Hayden agrees. He's with the group Conservatives Concerned About the Death Penalty. He says death is neither pro-life nor fiscally responsible.
And I don't think that it's representative of a limited government, so why would we trust them with life and death decisions?
But prosecutor Bernie De La Rionda does not agree. He's an assistant state attorney in Jacksonville and in favor of the death penalty. He says the death penalty is expensive, only because of frivolous appeals.
Still, the process takes too long.
He says some murderers deserve death.
When they stab somebody 67 times, in most cases that victim is begging for their life.
Northeast Florida State Attorney Angela Corey also weighed in.
So what I am concerned about are misperceptions by people who didn't actually live through these cases the way Bernie and I and our other prosecutors have.
In Florida, it takes a majority vote to sentence someone to the death penalty, while in most death penalty states, a unanimous vote is required. The Florida Supreme Court is considering a case challenging that requirement. Lindsay Kilbride, WJCT News.
Now, a local homicide case is sparking continued conversation about the death penalty and this judicial circuit. Jacksonville's Farah family says they do want justice for the murder of their daughter, Shelby Farah. Shelby was killed in July of 2013. But what does justice mean? Death for her killer or life in prison? It's a complicated story and one that is explored in this week's Folio Weekly. Here with more, we welcome writer Julie Delegal in studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And joining us by phone, Mark Hayden, National Coordinator with Conservatives Concerned About the Death Penalty. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And here's our question to callers. Are you for or against the death penalty? What are your questions about how the statute is applied in our circuit here in Florida? Get on the line now at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. Let's talk about Shelby Farah first off. Julie Delegal, tell us about her family and her situation and why this is in the news.
Hi, Melissa. I got to talk to Shelby's mother, Darlene Farah, her younger brother, Caleb, and her younger sister, Nicole. And just walking into that house, you could feel the stress. You could cut it with a knife. I first got to know them right after that July hearing where the defendant in the case was found to be not disabled. And basically, the son, especially the younger brother, Caleb, was just crushed because he thought it might be an opportunity to just wrap up this case and for them to move on with their lives. Had he been disabled, the state, of course, would not be able to pursue the death penalty.
The state wants to pursue the death penalty for Shelby's killer, a guy named Rhodes. The family doesn't want the death penalty, though. Why not?
Darlene will tell you that she says Shelby is in heaven. She's worried about her other two kids. This is their senior year. She wants stability and some semblance of normalcy as much as a family can get when their loved one has been murdered. It's not for him. She's not fighting for his life, and she makes that very clear. She has forgiven him, she says, for her own sanity to be able to just get on with life. But it wrecks them. She didn't go out of her house for days after that particular hearing. They are just, it's the kind of thing where you're going through something and you think it's going to wrap up and you think if you just hang on a little while longer, it's going to be over. And that's been happening for 2 years for this family, and it's not over.
So they want closure, and they would rather just end this than continue to see the death penalty appeals?
Yeah, they will never forget Shelby, she says, but the emotional turmoil that this family is going through is re-stimulated every time something happens in the case. She says she just doesn't think she has the strength to make it through the first trial.
Mark Hyden with Conservatives Concerned About the Death Penalty. You spoke about this at a forum Friday at the First Coast Tiger Bay Club, and you'll be speaking at another event in Jacksonville tonight. What about the prosecutor's argument, State Attorney Angela Corey and Prosecutor Bernie De La Rionda, that when they walk this journey with families who've seen a loved one murdered, who do want death for their family member's killer, that they feel it's appropriate and just?
Well, first of all, when it comes to murder victims, friends and family members, rarely is the whole family unanimous in the punishment that they want to seek. So they're actually pitting family members against each other when they make the decision to seek death as opposed to life without parole. And I heard Bernie in the recording say that the high costs actually come from just frivolous appeals. And I have to push back on that because I don't think there's anything frivolous about the 25 people who were wrongly convicted using the appeals process to prove that they're wrongly sentenced to death to be released. So in the end, we're seeing a government program that risks innocent lives, costs tons of money, millions more than life without parole, but it does not protect society. We've seen plenty of studies that show that there is no deterrent effect when it comes to executions. So in the end, it's a failed government program that really serves no purpose and harms murder victims' friends and family members.
So you feel that there's a conservative case to be made to do away with the death penalty?
Oh, absolutely. You know, when I speak at colleges and tea parties across the United States, I always try to break it down into the conservative litmus test. We believe that programs should be pro-life, fiscally responsible, and representative of a limited government. We know the death penalty is not pro-life because it risks innocent life. There's no such thing as a perfect government program, and this program is far from perfect. And we know it's not fiscally responsible because it's led to tax increases, and it costs many times more than life without parole. And in the end, I don't think it's representative of a limited government, and I don't think it's wise to invest our government with this kind of power, especially since many conservatives don't trust the government to even deliver mail.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking about a local death penalty case this morning. We'll go to your calls in a moment. Let us know where you stand on the death penalty at 549-2937. Julie Delegal, a recent Gallup poll on the death penalty shows that by a sizable majority, Americans are still in favor of the death penalty. What about that? Public opinion is against Mark Hyden's position. Most Americans seem to think it's appropriate if a person is convicted of murder.
I think that's a widely held belief, Melissa, and I think it's very widely held here in Northeast Florida. My father was a homicide detective. He supported the death penalty. He taught me that we don't take joy in it, however, and he also had a deep respect for all of this stuff that Bernie De La Rionda is calling frivolous appeals. There's nothing frivolous about putting someone to death. My father would have called it due process of law. It's a very controversial issue. The more I learn about it, the more I oppose the death penalty.
You also write in your piece that our circuit, the Fourth Judicial Circuit here in North Florida, administers the death penalty far more often than other circuits around the state. Why is that?
Well, I think politics probably underlies a lot of that. The other part of this that maybe left out of the conversation sometimes is that the state attorney's office in the Fourth Judicial Circuit is pretty good at this. Bernie De La Rionda has been practicing over there for probably 30 years by now, and they've become very good at what they do.
So Mark Hyden, with Conservatives Concerned About the Death Penalty, when you see this polling on this issue, do you feel that it's an uphill battle, particularly among Republicans who tend to favor a tough-on-crime approach?
Well, we've had great success working with the grassroots in Republican circles and conservative circles, and I work with the grass tops like Colonel Oliver North, Dr. Ron Paul, and even the former RNC chairman, Michael Steele. So there is a desire from the right to end what is a utterly broken government program. But when you look at these polls, it's important to look at what they're actually asking. They're asking more of a theoretical question. Do you think the death penalty is an appropriate response to certain crimes? If you change that question and offer something to replace the death penalty with, the numbers change dramatically. And I can point to a PPP poll in North Carolina where 68% of North Carolinians supported repealing and replacing the death penalty with life without parole plus restitution. And the majority of those were self-described conservatives.
Let's go to your calls. Where do you stand on the death penalty? As a local family argues that they don't want death for their daughter's killer, 549-2937. Bill is in McClenny. Hey, Bill. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey. Yeah, go ahead.
I agree with anybody that's for the death penalty. If somebody's caught with a smoking gun in their hand, they've got no right to an appeal. And they should be quick. They should get the death penalty and as quickly as possible.
Bill, thanks for the call. What about that argument, Julie Delegal? People think that the death penalty should be administered, but without appeals.
You can't administer the death penalty without appeals. It's unconstitutional. You're taking away somebody's life. And we as a society, I don't think we want to live in a society where we're going to do that callously. You know, Bill, if you walk into the room and pick up a smoking gun after somebody's been murdered, you're going to want the best representation possible.
Warren is in Mandarin. Hey, Warren, thanks for holding. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, I am opposed to the death penalty, which has changed from the way I felt at one time. I was on a first-degree murder jury. Found it very interesting. Convicted the man. The people on the jury, some of them wanted to hold off on making an announcement so they could get another free meal. Now, when we got to the death penalty part, and I did vote on a split 7-5, there were people who were wanting to hurry through it because there was a TV program coming on at 8 o'clock that they wanted to get home in time to listen to. The conviction was upheld. As I understand it, the death sentence that the judge gave was thrown out, and he resentenced the person to life. I also rather object to it with the number of convictions that have been thrown out here lately, 20 some odd as I recall, and that's just the ones that they have gotten to and have re-examined the cases. And I'll take any comments offline.
Okay. Thank you, Warren. That's Warren in Mandarin. Mark Hyden with Conservatives Concerned About the Death Penalty. How do you figure that the introduction of DNA evidence into some of these homicide cases has affected the discussion when convictions do sometimes get later thrown out?
Well, the Innocence Project has been doing amazing work with DNA evidence, which has opened the door to proving that some people have been wrongly convicted, and they're introducing this exculpatory DNA evidence that shows that they're wrongly put there. But I want to caution everyone that we don't live in a CSI universe, that those TV shows we see aren't real. DNA is actually only available in up to 10% of all criminal cases. And even worse, we're finding that forensic evidence is often falsified and even forged, and sometimes it's just inaccurate by the state. So some of the technology that we rely on is oftentimes a rarity and sometimes inaccurate.
Let's go to a few of your tweets on the death penalty. Cindy tweets the show, "Every reason to oppose the death penalty is a good one, and there are plenty of reasons to stop the death penalty." Here's another tweet. "What about the company you keep? China, Iran, North Korea, Yemen, and the U.S. are some of the only countries that still execute people." Julie Delegal, let's talk about that for a moment. The U.S. has become somewhat of an outlier in terms of how we apply the death penalty.
It certainly is. Duval County is a big part of that outlier status. Duval County is in a very small minority of counties. 2% of counties in this country send 56% of convicted murders to death row. I think it's political. I think it's the law and order brand of politics that has been in play for quite a while in this country.
And we want your calls. Let us know whether you're for or against the death penalty, and let us know your thoughts why at 549-2937. Valencia is on the north side. Hey, Valencia, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I would want to first say I'm against the death penalty. My caveat to that, however, is if the convicted criminal wants the death penalty for himself, then albeit, let's honor his wishes. I believe we should do life without parole. In addition, we should have that individual with a no-contact order, meaning their friends, family cannot communicate, no phone calls, no letters, because that kind of puts them in the position of, especially in where someone's life has been taken, that they now are completely separated as the individual whose life they may have taken is separated.
Thanks, Valencia.
While they're there.
All right.
You're welcome.
Valencia on the north side. Mark Hyden, what about her arguments?
Well, you know, I mean, there's a lot of things we can talk about, what policies to implement to try to replace the death penalty. But I think our focus should be on ending a program that leads to tax increases and risks innocent lives. Once we get rid of that, we can talk about the appropriate measures to implement in order to have a just system in place.
And how do you go about doing that? As Julie Delegal just pointed out, some counties apply it more aggressively than others, but about half the states still have a death penalty in place. What's your strategy, Mark, with your organization to change that dynamic?
Well, first of all, we try to educate people because there's many misconceptions out there when it comes to the death penalty. So we're doing that. But also we're trying to push for the death penalty to be repealed on a state-by-state legislative basis, and I think that's the conservative way of doing it. Since we found out that the death penalty cannot be fixed and cannot work perfectly, and it's very arbitrary and used capriciously, we believe that the best option out there is simply to get rid of this program, especially since it doesn't give anything back to society.
Lots of calls on this. CJ on the south side. Hey, CJ, what are your thoughts?
Oh, hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. You know, this is a very important conversation. I'm glad that you're having it this morning. You know, for me, my views have evolved over the years. I was for it, but I've come out against it for a couple of reasons. First of all, you know, just the obvious thing is in the Ten Commandments, it says, thou shalt not kill. There's no asterisk near it. That's just the way it is. And then secondly, it's actually not a deterrent. You know, states that have the death penalty have virtually no difference in the murder rate compared to those states that have abolished it. And there have been wrongful convictions, as previously mentioned, there have been wrongful convictions of the death penalty. And with the advent of DNA exonerative evidence, people have been cleared, and I'm just worried that there actually have been people that have been put to death that have been wrongfully convicted. So echoing with a lot of what the guests have been saying is that it's the right thing to do is to get rid of it and for us to really become more of a civilized nation compared to other industrialized nations in the world. I think it would be best that we abolish the death penalty. Thank you.
Thank you, CJ. Let's take one more call. Barbara in Jacksonville. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I have a very personal stake in this. My daughter was shot and killed. And
I'm so sorry, Barbara. I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yeah, well, I feel very strongly that the state has no business being in the business of putting people to death. And at no time did I want the death penalty for her killer. What I really want is emphasis put on taking away the availability of guns. Had he not had a gun available to him, my daughter would still be alive.
What happened with your daughter's case, Barbara? What happened with her convicted killer?
He was sentenced to life in prison.
Okay. Barbara, I'm so sorry for that, and thank you for sharing that. So, Julie Delegal, let's sum up by talking about where the case against Shelby Ferris' killer stands. What's next with it?
There's a court date in October. The trial is set for May. I know that there's been yet another attempt by the public defender to plead the case, which has failed. You know, the Farahs are struggling in a milieu where we are spending an embarrassment of riches trying to put somebody to death. It's hard for me to get my head around that irony, but that's what's happening.
Mark Hyden, you'll be speaking in Jacksonville tonight about this issue, yes?
That's right. I'll be speaking with the Liberty on the Rocks group at Goozle Pipe and Gutty Works at 914 King Street at 6:30 p.m., and I hope all of your guests come in and bring a friend.
All right. Well, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Julie Delagala, Folio Weekly, Mark Hyden with Conservatives Concerned About the Death Penalty, and much more still to come later. Don't miss it as Cole Pepper and I speak with new Jack Sons owner Ken Babby. But up next, a preview of tonight's PBS event, America After Charleston. We're back in a moment.
Join WJCT for a dinner honoring this year's American Graduate Champions, Wednesday, September 30th, 6 p.m. at the WJCT studios. Hear their stories and learn how their efforts are making a difference in increasing graduation rates here on the First Coast. For more information and tickets, 358-6327, WJCT.org.
Follow what's happening at WJCT, even when you're away from your radio. You can follow WJCT on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can listen live online to WJCT-FM at wjct.org/listen, or on iTunes Radio or TuneIn Radio. And you can hear all of your favorite WJCT-FM shows anytime on demand on iTunes and Stitcher. Wherever you are, WJCT is there.
5 years ago, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg went on Oprah and pledged $100 million to help Newark, New Jersey's failing schools. On the next Fresh Air, journalist Dale Russikoff tells us about the outcome of that experiment and what it teaches us about how to implement school reform. Russikoff's new book is called The Prize. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Imagine a table and chairs, 3.5 times normal size. Now imagine being under that table and chairs at a new museum of post-war and contemporary art in Los Angeles.
We sit at tables to eat our breakfast or do our homework, but here we are, underneath one.
Talking about art to kids at the Broad. That's coming up on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Weekdays at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Welcome back. Well, tonight on WJCT Television, it's America After Charleston, a one-hour town hall meeting that explores the many issues propelled into our public discourse after a white gunman shot and killed 9 African-American parishioners in Charleston's Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in June of 2015. Gwen Ifill, PBS NewsHour co-anchor and managing editor and moderator of Washington Week, will moderate tonight's special broadcast. Here now with their thoughts, we have two local activists, Shavara Oren. Good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And Ron Davis, father of Jordan Davis and head of the Jordan Davis Foundation. Good to see you.
Good morning. Glad to be back.
And what are your thoughts about America After Charleston, issues of race and gun violence? Get on the line now at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect and email and tweet the show. Shavara, you traveled to Charleston shortly after the mass shootings. Let's talk a little bit about what you experienced when you went up there.
Sure. I traveled with a dear close friend who's also who also lives here in Jacksonville, and we went a week after the shootings. We actually attended a church service that was made up and comprised of many different people, people who were Christian and Jews and Muslim and Hindu, and they were coming together to try to find answers and healing in a church that was a sister church to the church where this tragedy occurred. And one of the things that was very striking is how the community had really come together. There were, when we visited the church where the shooting had taken place, there were Black people and white people and Latino people, and there were young people and there were elders there, and they were all coming together and trying to make sense of this tragedy at the same time. And I think what I was most struck by, we're celebrating, you know, in some ways 50 years after the Civil Rights Act and 50 years after the Voting Rights Act, but we're also commemorating those lives lost of four little Black girls, Addie Mae Collins, Denise McNair, Carol Robertson, and Cynthia Wesley, who on September 15th in 1963 were also killed when four white male members of a Ku Klux Klan splinter group charged with bombing the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham. So we're not that far removed. And unfortunately, we are seeing this play over and over again in our community. And it is a longstanding history of domestic terrorism in Black churches, not only across the South, but certainly specifically in the South.
Ron Davis, you're the father of the late Jordan Davis, the Jacksonville teen who was killed by Michael Dunn. That case, of course, received national attention and led to an award-winning documentary film, which is currently making the rounds. As we prepare to watch this program tonight on PBS, what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, the 3.5 minutes, 10 bullets, our film, we will be showing it actually this weekend at the New York at the Urban Festival. And so Urban World Festival in New York will show that in other films that's regarding the Charleston incident. I was actually in Charleston. I was invited to come to Charleston, and we have got a private tour of the sanctuary. And you have an eerie feeling when you go in the sanctuary knowing that there were 9 lives that were taken in that sanctuary, and I felt Jordan within me. And it really shook me. I had to sit down in the sanctuary. I couldn't just stand. My knees just kind of got rubbery. It's very powerful to go to that church. You know, it's very powerful to see the people around that church that are still praying and signing little boards they have there. They have little crosses that they sign there. So Charleston is very near and dear to me. As a matter of fact, I got a call recently, about 3 days ago, from Judy Scott, which is the mother of Walter Scott, the young man that was killed, shot in the back in North Charleston, South Carolina. And his mother called me because, you know, they came out and started victimizing the victim again because they said, well, he had a little cocaine in his system, which a tiny amount, and he also had a little alcohol in his system. And his mother, listening to that and seeing that on the news, it's like, you know, what does that have to do with my son getting shot in the back 6 times and they're trying to put a taser next to my son's body? And they never came out with the toxicology or any type of report from the policeman, what he had in his system. And so there again, you victimize the victim.
We'll go to your calls on America After Charleston in a moment at 549-2937. Shavara, of course, you're the daughter of the late civil rights activist James Bevel, who marched and organized with Martin Luther King, Dr. Martin Luther King. And so when we talk about Charleston and how in the wake of that mass shooting, the Confederate flag came down outside the state capitol in South Carolina, national movement Black Lives Matter picked up more steam. Race and the changing demographic landscape of this country have become a central topic in the 2016 presidential election, which is just around the corner. These are issues, though, that I think are still very divisive in this country. When people are listening, and we'll take calls in a moment, not everyone's on the same page, to say the least. When you talk about these issues in the community and you talk to people with a different point of view than your own, how do you interact with them about it? Because Black Lives Matter in particular seems to have generated a lot of divisiveness.
Thank you for that question and that thought, Melissa. You know, one of the things that I'd like to actually piggyback on something that Ron was just saying, in our nation, we continue to perpetuate corrosive, racist media narrative as it relates to the difference between Black victims, Black perpetrators, white victims, white perpetrators, which certainly lends itself to the divisiveness that we are experiencing. recently, a month or so after the Charleston massacre, the New York Times CBS News poll that was conducted revealed that nearly 6 in 10 Americans, including heavy majorities of both whites and blacks, think race relations are generally bad and that they are getting worse. And when we think about the Confederate flag, the division that surrounds that, 57% in the same survey, 57% of whites said that they considered it mostly an emblem of Southern pride, while 68% of blacks said that they saw it more as a symbol of racism. Part of the real challenge that we have outside of the historical context for what's happening right now in America, right now, unemployment rates for blacks are still double that for whites, and black households earn 40% less. So unless we are talking about systemic institutional change in our political system, in our economic system and base, we are not going to see real change. One of the things I think that has surfaced more this time than ever, and I know I personally experienced it after Charleston, we have been so used to for hundreds of years, for centuries, of black people turning the other cheek and this sense of forgiveness. There is rage. I know I experienced rage when I saw the massacre in Charleston. I think that, you know, we have to be very, very mindful that we can't just ask black people, people of color, to turn the other cheek when there has been this historical white aggression, oppression, and subjugation and discrimination against people of color. And so when we're encountering people who have differences, because you do have many white people in our community thinking that things are better for black people, and what they point to is, well, we had a black mayor and there is a black president, when in reality, there are more hate groups now than ever since President Obama's election. And those are the types of things that we really have to delve into in our communities when we have honest conversations about race relations really mean.
Amel in Jacksonville. Thanks for holding, Amel. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes. I spoke to you 4 years ago. I told you I was not allowed to see my children or even talk to them. And that was July 29, 2010. Is the last time I spoke to them, or I was allowed to speak to them or even see them in the court. And I have no crime. Nothing against me. My case has gone from Duval County Courthouse to First District, from First District to the Middle Court, from the Middle Court to the 11th District. And none of the defendants have any response to my queries.
Okay, Amel, stay on the line because we want to help you out with that. Stay on the line so we can get your number and help you out with that. But right now, let's take a few more calls. Angela in Jacksonville. Go ahead, Angela. Angela, you're on the air.
Oh, yes, ma'am. I just wanted to call and let the callers know that I do agree that the nation did come together for Charleston. But I also wanted to agree with the female speaker who said that I think we have to go a little deeper. I think that it's easier to come together in tragedy because what happened there was so obviously egregious. But I think one of the ways that we can go about healing is finding the ways in which it's not so obviously egregious to everyone and address those issues. And that way we can all work together to make a better future, because if we don't address the underlying racism that's in this country, we can't move forward together.
Angela, thanks for the call. Ron Davis, what about her comments?
I think she's perfectly right. You know, we actually took the film 3.5 minutes, 10 Bullets, to Charleston about a little over a month ago. And we screened it at the Wells Fargo Auditorium there at the Beatty Center School of Business. And we had what we call black Googlers. You know, they work for Google and some of them work for YouTube. And this is the way that we thought that we would amplify black voices, is that if we get the Googlers, which they touch about 12 million people at a time, then we can get these people together. And instead of sitting down at one table, we can be across the nation sitting down and talking about this issue. So I completely agree with her. I agree with what Shavara was saying, is that, you know, it is not over. Racism exists. It's live and well, and we have to do positive things to get rid of it, because what the white supremacist is trying to do right now is trying to have a all-out war, and we got to stop this in this country.
549-2937, Wells at the Beaches. Hi, Wells.
Hi. Hi, Melissa.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to suggest to the listeners, I participated in the talk that was given, Race in the River City, on WJCT.
Yeah.
And I raised at that time that we need to really start looking at institutionalized racism in the United States. And the discussion really didn't go far on that show. But I would suggest to listeners to read through things that might help them understand institutionalized racism and how it has affected African Americans since we arrived in this country. And one of them is an article by Ta-Nehisi Coates, who writes for the
Atlantic Magazine.
Yeah.
Yes, he has an article, and it's, I think, a second part of an article, the first part. It's called Black Families in the Age of Mass Incarceration. And the other thing that I would suggest that listeners read is The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. Because we have a situation in America that has gone on since 1619, and I don't think most white Americans really understand this. I was looking at an old piece by James Baldwin. He was speaking at a luncheon press conference was giving him back in 95, I think. And he suggested, and everybody thought it was funny at the time, that there really needs to be a White History Month for white people to really understand and get to know the history of America and how it has affected African Americans and how it continues to affect African Americans. So I just wanted to add that, and I'll take whatever comments you have off the air.
Thanks, Wells. Wells at the beaches. Shavara.
You know, thank you so much for that comment. You're right. One of the things that came out of the Charleston shooting, I remember thinking that President Obama became Reverend Obama when he spoke. And one of the things that he said that really resonated with me, he said, far too long we've been blind to the way past injustices continue to shape the present. One of the things that has come out, I think, that's very positive in the wake of, unfortunately, not just this mass shooting, but all of the video footage we have seen, there's been a barrage of what we have seen as the American public of police brutality against people of color. And so you have a reawakening of sorts, a reawakening of awareness with social media and all of the activists, not just Black Lives Matter, but the people that write for Mike and Wells mentioned Ta-Nehisi Coates. He also has the case for reparations that he wrote a few months ago that also speaks to this dilemma that we have in America. Ron and I are actually working with a committee currently. We've met with the new sheriff and administration to talk about what does that look like in our own community in Jacksonville? How might we have better community policing? How do we build and strengthen relationships between the police and the community, especially when historically that relationship has been very tenuous in Black and brown and poor communities.
And on a hopeful note, Ron Davis, the new sheriff, Mike Williams, has reached out and is engaging with groups around town on these issues. What are your thoughts as we close out the segment?
Well, you know, as when I spoke to Mike, one of the things, you know, we discussed was having the body cameras. And you know, he was telling me about the budget and, you know, what Jacksonville can afford. But you know what? I think Jacksonville can not afford to not have body cameras. You know, we use money for so many different projects in Jacksonville. I think one of the best projects to use it for would be body cameras to save lives and also to get back the community to thinking that, you know, it's not a war zone. You know, the police with the body cameras, they seem to be more able to go into the community and feel like they're a part of the community because they know they're being watched, and also the community know that they're being watched. So Rialto, California, they experimented for a year with body cameras and crime went down 89%. That's very telling. And the police said that the community came out to them you know, better suited to say, you know what, you're a part of us. And so I think we have to get back to community. So I don't think we can use the excuse that we don't have it in the budget. I think we need the, you know, I'm very hopeful that we're going to have the body cameras. In addition to that, you know, the police here have to understand that it's not them against us. You know, protect and serve really means something. And so if you're going to protect and serve, and then you cannot look at everybody as the perpetrator of a crime. When you look at somebody, you look at them as a mother, a father, a sister, or a brother. And that's how we have to do it.
Well, we thank you both so much for being with us today. It's sure to be an important hour of television tonight. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Ron Davis is the father of Jordan Davis, head of the Jordan Davis Foundation. We were also joined by local activist Shavara Oren, a daughter of the late civil rights activist James Bevel. And tonight on WJCT Television, it's America After Charleston, a one-hour town hall hosted by Gwen Ifill. And we're back in a moment with Cole on sports and a conversation with the new owner of the Jacksonville Suns. That's next.
Hello, I'm Steve Woodard, the Director of Emergency Preparedness for the City of Jacksonville. Knowing your evacuation zone is critical to your safety. Listen to emergency management for important evacuation information. And stay informed at jacksready.com and tune to 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
From the European settlement of the New World to America's manned exploration of space, Florida helps define the boundaries of the modern era. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll look at the spirit of discovery in Florida. We'll discuss the World War I papers of Hamilton R. Horsey and rum runner Bill McCoy. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
WJCT is proud to be your number one preset for your evening commute. But if you only turn on 89.9 when you're driving, here's what you're missing.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for
listening. This is The World.
Spend your afternoons with WJCT for unique conversations about the topics of the day. Join us weekdays from 2 to 6 for The Takeaway, The World, and All Things Considered. It's the smart way to spend your afternoon.
The Pope preaches about a whole lot of things, including the markets.
He says, the markets which immediately benefit from sales stimulate ever greater demand, as if there's some sort of conspiracy to get people to buy air conditioners.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Capitalism as Francis sees it, next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Welcome back. Time to talk sports. Our own Cole Pepper is here. And also in studio, new Jacksonville Suns owner Ken Babby. He's making the rounds and making some big moves at the ballpark. Ken, Cole, good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good
morning. Great to be here.
It's good to see you. Ken, you're a young guy taking over the Suns from the storied Bragan family. Lots of excitement as you're getting a new look and a new approach going for our minor league ball team.
Yeah, it's just such a pleasure to be part of the community. It's been a wonderful warm welcome, and thanks so much for having me this morning.
You've done this before. You own another minor league baseball team.
Yeah, it's a dream come true to wake up and come to the ballpark every day. I do. I own the AA affiliate of the Cleveland Indians in Akron, Ohio. The team's called the Akron Rubber Ducks, based on the tire industry being based in. That's home.
And that team was not called the Rubber Ducks when you took over, was it?
It was not. Yeah. In fact, it had a strange name. It was called the Akron Arrows, based on some aeronautical work there. But Akron's still
Akron
the Rubber
Ducks. Akron Arrows.
Yeah,
and you changed it to the Rubber Ducks.
Yeah, we had a naming contest in town in 2010, 2011, and it was overwhelming that fans wanted to see some change there.
So are we going to see the same thing in Jacksonville?
It's a great question. You know, I think it's a very different situation here. I think fans really love the name the Jacksonville Suns. They're embracing the kind of emails that I've received in the last couple of months, really since buying the team, have been overwhelming. That the Suns are a huge part of the tradition of the community here.
Yeah.
And so at the moment, no plans to change the name. If that were to ever change, it would be driven by the community.
But you are making some changes, right? You're
going
to do some things differently. What's up your sleeve?
Yeah, so I mean, for fans that have enjoyed the baseball grounds, since it opened, and now almost 15 years ago, amazingly, this ballpark has continued to grow, but so has minor league baseball. So new picnic areas, fans can look forward to you know, new party areas, new facility areas, but all at an affordable price. So you'll always be able to get into the baseball grounds for just a few bucks. You know, we've talked about hot dogs being $2 every single game. That'll be something fans can look forward to. Whole new list of culinary options, a cleaner, crisper looking baseball grounds. And so, you know, it's hard to believe 200 days from opening day, but we'll have it all ready to go.
You know, one of the things that has made the Suns the success that they have been has been that it has been an affordable family day out.
That's right.
The success on the field is almost doesn't even matter to the in terms of attendance and enjoyment of the game. Does that change at all in your mind? You know, does success on the field matter at all? Should it matter more? And are you going to continue to push toward that affordable family atmosphere kind of message?
I think you hit it on the head. I mean, I think there's certainly a segment of fans that come and want to see, and we will deliver the very best in AA baseball as prospects are on their way down to Miami to be in the major leagues. But I will tell you that the core audience for minor league baseball is there for the family experience.
Now, you're 35 years old.
I am 35 years old.
Such a generational...
And bald, but radio audience can't see that. I have a good face for radio.
You are a young guy, and this is such a generational passing of the torch. You're a millennial taking over this sports franchise. How do you see that changeover?
Well, I think, you know, sports is such an interesting thing. Sports teams in general are evolutions, right, in different chapters. And this is just the next chapter in Jacksonville Suns baseball. And so we will be a little bit more vibrant. We will be a little bit younger. We will feel perhaps a little bit louder. But the experience at the ballpark will still be that same magical experience for families every night.
Now, you also share the ballpark with the Jacksonville Armada. You've had conversations with Mark Frisch, the owner there?
Yeah, Mark's been great. I mean, Mark and I are roughly the same age. He has a little bit more hair left on his head than I do, but he's done a wonderful job in the community of launching this, really sort of devising the playbook for a great experience. And we're getting ready. We'll be operating from a food and beverage standpoint the Armada game this Saturday. So fans can look forward to already an improved and exciting experience at the ballpark.
Do you want to go ahead, Paul?
I was going to say, how do you see that relationship, though, when you have two tenants of basically the same building? Have you experienced that before, and how do you see it working?
Yeah, we have, and it's a function of great scheduling and good communication. And we have great partners in SMG and the Armada and the city of Jacksonville. Look, at the end of the day, taxpayers paid great money to build this facility. It should be used as much as possible. And we'll make sure that the field is at the adequate standards for both soccer and for baseball, and that it's a great experience.
Now, you're a sports fan. You love all sports, right?
I do. Baseball's first, although we're excited about a Jaguars win yesterday.
Speaking of which, do you want to stick around while Cole talks about the Jaguars and maybe give your comments to that as well?
Oh, boy. I'll try.
Okay.
Well, let's start with the fact that for the first time since 2012, the Jaguars won a game in the month of September. It had been a long time since they had done that. The last 2 years, they started 0-8 and 0-6. So I called this the most important game of a week two schedule that the Jaguars have ever had because of what comes next. They have to go on the road to face New England and then Indianapolis away. But the Jaguars got it done thanks to a hot start by Blake Bortles and then some key defensive plays down the stretch, including made by Jaron Odrick, who turned in a big performance. One of the big performances turned in on the offensive side by Allen Robinson, the Penn State wide receiver, second-year man, had six catches and 165 yards and two touchdowns. And afterwards, he was a little low-key about his performance and what it meant.
We really can't, concern ourselves with that. You know, I mean, we know throughout the course of the season, you know, it's going to be a lot of ups and there's going to be some downs, you know. So, I mean, we really can't concern ourselves, you know, or really panic, you know, on how we played last week. You know, that's why we have, 14 more games now, you know. So, I mean, each and every week is a new opportunity.
You know, on the defensive side, I mentioned Jaron Odrick, a former Miami Dolphin. All week he had been saying that this was just another game. He was going to approach it as the same thing. But he admitted after the game that may not have been exactly accurate.
I was lying all week. I was very excited. This was not just another game. And it feels good to be able to say that after, you know, a win. But, I just got to thank my D-line for being able to put me in this position.
The other guy to point out here is Jason Myers. He's the young kicker that the Jaguars kept in favor of Josh Scobie, who they traded off to the Pittsburgh Steelers. Myers not only hit a 58-yard field goal that hit the crossbar and went in, second longest field goal in Jaguars history, he also nailed the go-ahead, what would be game-winning field goal at the end. And that was one of the big questions. Are you going to get rid of the reliable veteran kicker Josh Scobie for a young guy? if that's the case, he better be able to make that kick when pressure is on. It was almost bigger for him to hit the shorter winning field goal than it was to hit the 58-yarder, which was certainly a big one.
But, you know, it's exciting to see them win. It's like you said, I think people were going to this game thinking, oh, gosh, this is not going to go so well.
And I'm not sure this is a cure-all for the Jaguars fans who are still concerned about the direction of things, but it certainly makes them feel a lot better on a Monday morning.
Can you get to town and we finally win a football game?
Listen, how about it? Listen, I think the thing that stands out to me the most from yesterday's game, and I was at actually the Washington game in D.C. I grew up a Redskins fan, so I understand the pain that fans of Jacksonville feel, but I raced home to watch the game at 4. I will tell you this. I thought Blake Bortles had amazing presence in the pocket yesterday. Uh-huh. Big difference between week 1 and week 2. I mean, he really looked like a solidified NFL quarterback yesterday. And I think that is a big win beyond just the W in the standings.
He really showed what he showed in the preseason, what everybody expected to see this year, which maybe means that last week's loss was an aberration. Jaguars fans have their fingers crossed.
Yeah, let's hope so. In the meantime, always great to see you, Cole Pepper, and new Suns owner Ken Babby in studio. How about it? Thanks for being here, Ken.
Thank you, guys.
Best of luck on the upcoming season. Follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper for the rest of the sports highlights from the weekend. College football and the Armada, lots to talk about. And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme, composed and performed by the Symphony's Pyotr Shevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And next on Die and Ream, Pope Francis arrives in the U.S. this week, his first visit ever. A closer look coming up. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow with a closer look at efforts to make this area more pedestrian and bike-friendly, even on the Arlington Expressway. That's right. That's tomorrow. See you then.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.